This is the Brisbane Football Review with your host, James Coghlan.
The best ideas come about 20 seconds too late in my experience. Scott Owen.
There's a mute button, people, don't worry.
And Adam Pace.
Well, look, I'm going to feel like that, you know, I'm the one who shot Barbie's mother.
Starting now.
Well, there's no public holiday for us on the Brisbane Football Review because, well, we've got an entire season to recap on this finale for, what is it, season 8, Adam, I believe? Yes, okay, you're nodding. All right, well, hello everyone. It's time for us to go through and recap the last 8, 9, 10 months or whatever it is. Scott, how are you?
I'm good, and as your old NFL coach, you say no days off, James.
In the end, it became no days off.
I did too. How are you, James?
I'm doing well. I'm just hoping that when I leave this show, I will have more interest in my services than what he's had in the last few months.
Oh, no, he was pretty good during draft week.
Oh, that's true. Well, we'll just have to wait and see. Although I don't think I quite
maybe he'll send you to draft week.
Yeah, as long as it's the NFL draft and not the drafts they used to have for Vietnam or something.
Well, we can either confirm or deny.
Well. Oh, we'll have to renegotiate that.
Yeah, I can see on Scott's desk, he's actually got the, please send James over into the military so he can learn a thing or two.
It's a long list of places, yep.
Yeah. All right, well, look, we've already gone off the rails and we've barely been talking for 75 seconds, so how's that for a good start? But, this is our normal season recap, I guess, and also, if you missed the announcement a couple of weeks ago, this will be my final episode as the full-time host of the Brisbane Football Review. So you got plenty of reasons to tune in. And for some reason, Scott and Adam have looked happier than I've ever seen them in the last 3 or 4 years with the knowledge that I'll be gone from the regular shows after this.
Oh, we'll wait to the end.
Champagne is on ice just over there.
All right, let's get into it. So we've done the women's season recap. This is for the men's team. Let's start with I've got to be honest, pretty disappointing, all things considered, for the Raw. Based on the preseason recruitment, I thought they'd be better than they were. Based on the Australia Cup, I thought they would be contending for a top four. But I'll take the lead from Kaz Pataftas' statement a little while ago that it's a year that has fallen short of expectations, Scott. And I suppose there's no better way to sum it up than that.
Yeah, that sums up quite nicely. It's a year that did fall short of expectations, particularly after the way, you're right, the Australia Cup campaign went. There was such hope in the fan bases that this was going to be a season where Brisbane Roar returned to being a team that were a contender in the competition. And for the first 2 weeks, it kind of looked like they were going to become that side, but a whole lot of reasons, which we'll get to over the next few minutes, were the catalyst to triggering that, and I guess 4 coaches in a season is never going to be a recipe for a finals push, but it did start off heading in the right direction.
It did, but it did start off well, at least, Adam.
It did, and a very, very strong Australia Cup campaign, and even a promising start to the league season. A couple of blips here and there. The loss to Wellington Phoenix at the time was a bit disappointing, but I think, as hindsight would say, Wellington Phoenix's form pretty much shut up all season, so a 5-2 loss at Sky Stadium probably wasn't the worst thing in hindsight. But for me, the season changed on the 24th of December when Ross Aloisi left. That was where it all fell off the rails. You could probably circle back and say maybe it was the change of management and all that, but Stephen, still, when Ross Aloisi announced he was leaving the Raw to go to take up assistant coach's role at Shanghai Port, who I understand are third in the Chinese Super League at the moment, that's where it completely fell off the rails as far as the Raw goes. A horror, yeah, December and January, and they never really recovered.
Yeah, for me, I think I would go back a couple of weeks before then. Sunday the 10th of December, 2-0 win in Adelaide. I think that was probably the peak of my optimism in terms of what the Raw could do this season. I'm sure if you go back and listen to the podcast episode that week, I don't think I went as far as to say they can compete for silverware, but top four suddenly becomes the bare minimum. And then that following Friday, they went down to Western United and just looked like a completely different team. And my completely unfounded 2+2=5 theory is, in that week, that was when it started to get unsettled that Ross Aloisi was not going to be here for the long-term future. And that's where it all really started to come unstuck. The loss to Western United, a pretty flat performance at home against the Mariners on the 21st of December, where I think a couple of hours after that match, Scott, that's when the Aloisi rumours really started to come out.
I think it was in the build-up to that game as well. There were some strong rumours in the media at that point in time. But it was certainly around that period of time after the Adelaide United game. You could certainly sense there was a real clear difference. Because that Adelaide game, they played so well away from home. And again, Adam mentioned the loss to Wellington away, probably not a bad thing not in hindsight. But beating Adelaide in Adelaide, maybe not as big of a result as we thought in hindsight either. But the way they played that day was so impressive. It gave you the confidence that we're going to be a team that could push for that top four, as you said. And then after that, it did genuinely fall apart in that Western United game where they didn't play to their best. The Central Coast game, you're right, was really, really flat. And then the game after that was the really low water mark, wasn't it? The Melbourne City game, where everything that could go wrong seemingly did go wrong.
It did. It was a pretty miserable festive period overall for the Raw. Luciano Trani took over for 90 minutes, basically, as the interim manager, oversaw the Raw's worst ever defeat in the A-League men, 8-1 down in Melbourne City. I'd rather not go into that game in too much detail because that was really, really depressing. But that was that. Not long after that game, Trani departed and in came Ben Kahn. And all things considered, Adam, that's a move that we kind of suspected would be happening eventually. It probably came 18 months to 2 years earlier than we expected it to, but the arrival of Ben Kahn did generate some optimism.
It did, but I want to take one step back, and I think the mistake that was made basically on the heels of Ross Aloisi's departure was there was panic set in. And after that record defeat, yeah, while it's not good and it's a stain on for the history books and all that, I think management, I mean Zach and Kaz, probably just panicked at the time. And you know, obviously that the fans were at their absolute bleating worst as far as, you know, the sky had fallen in, and perhaps be so readily, you know, accepting Luciano Trani's resignation. Rather than sort of at least allow it to breathe for a couple more weeks, at least give it a chance, because there's always was going to be a shock after Ross leaving. Melbourne City then proved as well that they are capable on their night to be able to put 7 or 8 goals on a team. They did 2 other times in the season, so it's not like that. Oh, it was completely Brisbane that just fell to pieces. They're probably the opportunists, Melbourne City, of doing that. But I think panicking by getting Ben Kahn straight away to take over, and then everything unfolded after that, I think that was sort of contributed to basically the season sort of falling apart.
Scott?
Yeah, I think that's pretty much what happened, isn't it? The best results in the season were very much in that first half of the year under Ross Aloisi. And it did feel like after that they were kind of chasing their tail a bit, James. And by the time it did get to Ruben Zankovic and his tenure in the back end of the season, it got a little bit better in the early phase of that results-wise. But at that point, they were a long way off the pace in terms of where they needed to be. That 4 or 5 game stretch over the festive period and through January where there was real instability in the coaching position, that ultimately is probably the thing that cost them the most in terms of that push for finals this year. And in addition to the squad issues, which we might get to later on.
Yeah, and you could see, like, it really did impact the players' performance as well. Like, they always felt like they were on the front foot under Aloisi, but the minute that changed, there was a clear drop-off in energy levels, and I think a lot of them probably felt like felt really let down by the way that had all unfolded. And I can kind of understand it, because those that have been here in the 22-23 season had gone through a change in manager as well, going from Warren Moon to Nick Green. Aloisi comes in, instills a whole new philosophy in the preseason, and then, 9-10 games in, he's gone.
The line that always resonates, that will always for me be the headline of that period, and Ben can't say a number of times, I know I parroted it on the show a lot as well in those weeks as well, the players have been through a lot. Now, looking back 4 or 5 months later, you got to ask yourself, how much did all this instability, all this drama cause the players as well, where to the point where their performances were not of professional footballs as far as being in control of the game. It was almost like literally playing for survival. It was almost like that they weren't sort of able to take any steps forward because they had this weighing on their mind. I asked the question, you know, being through a lot has to be more than just a change in coach or several coaches over there, but those players that are long-term. And maybe I'm overthinking it, but they're having, you know, 5, 6 changes of coach from 2022. Yeah, for some players, that's gonna really cause issues. Mainly for young players, probably more than anything else. But it also seemed like whatever they had been through, they were a shell of themselves from what they were probably at the start of the season, or at least going into that Australia Cup final.
There's probably also a few degrees of confusion as well, James. You talk about just putting aside the Nick Green and Warren Moon situation, which that was all of last season. This year, look at Ross Aloisi. He would have had a certain way of doing things, both in terms of training and also the way he wanted his team to play. Then Ben Kahn and his small time would have had a bit different to that, and then Ruben Zakovic different again, and even if they're not too dissimilar in terms of all three wanting to play on the front foot and attacking football, there are changes in the way you want the team to set up, the way you want players to operate within that system. So although all those things changing over time, I can see why it would be quite confusing and for the playing group as well.
And even just hearing the messages coming from different voices as well, they would all get delivered very differently. I think, like, from our time interacting with him, Ross would have been incredibly blunt. It worked. Oh, yeah. But, you know, you compare that to Ben as well, who's got much more of that quieter, measured delivery, and he would have, like, well, as you said, Adam, in his press conference, like, they've been through a lot, so he probably would have had to have really managed how he was delivering his message as well. And there were some signs of turnaround as well, until Ben Kahn stepped in and stepped away due to medical leave, which eventually saw him resign from his role as head coach of the Brisbane Roar. But I want to go back to Ben's opening press conference as well. And the one thing that, like, the one line that has sort of come back since the Kahn situation has been resolved is the way that I forget to ask him the question, but he said, yeah, I got the call Monday night saying, hey, you're running training Tuesday morning, which you do kind of wonder, like, you go back and what you guys were saying about the panic as well, and you just sort of wonder, was it, well, how much time did he have to just mentally get ready for it as well, and how much that would have impacted the way that he was able to come in and say, all right, I know how I've got to get this squad back up to the level it was playing at earlier in the season. But it did feel like the players just weren't sure how best to manage it themselves as well. And it showed in the results throughout January and into February, Scott.
It did. And people make the comparison of Ben Kahn to Warren Moon in a lot of ways. But in his time at the Roar, Warren had that period where he was there for a full season in that academy role before he stepped into the A-League's job. And he also, when he did get that A-League's head coaching job, it was right in the middle of the 2020 pandemic. He had a good few weeks there to be able to step in, take over training and assess and then build through the end of that season. Ben Kahn, as you said, found out one day, tomorrow morning, you're taking over training of the A-League head of the A-League men's team. And that's a very different situation where you just, he was doing a lot of work in the NPL to get ready for that moment. He would have felt he was ready, but just being dropped in like that, it's very, very different. And again, you can see why the confusion was there. With three coaches in the span of barely a month at that point, because I think Ruben Zakovic came in when they played Newcastle and Central Coast away back-to-back in about a 4 or 5 day span.
He came in as
the assistant at that point to provide some help for Ben at that point, because I think one of the assistants had left as well, and they wanted to have some more senior coaching experience around the group. So You can see that all that change in that period of time, you can see how confusing that would have been.
For sure. And then, yeah, like we've made no secret of our feelings on Ben as a coach and as a person and whatnot. And I think it really does suck that this is what his A-League head coaching experience has been. Hopefully he gets another shot at some point down the line, but that is first and foremost up to him based on what we know. So anyway, let's move on from that and say the fourth coach for the season, Ruben Zadkovic. Initially the interim, now the permanent head coach. And look, Ben walked into a horribly unstable situation as well, with players bereft of confidence, and I'm sure it would have been the same situation for Zadkovic. And he had a pretty solid early start to his tenure as well. It was the late equaliser against Wellington at Suncorp, big win over Melbourne City, which, you know, you two couldn't be bothered showing up to, and then the wildly entertaining but ultimately frustrating draw out in Perth. But overall, it was a pretty successful first month, Adam.
It was, and I'm pretty sure they actually lost that game against Perth, but nonetheless...
Well, that's why I said wildly entertaining but frustrating.
Yeah, no, but nonetheless, I think Ruben's got to get a lot of credit for that, because he was on an absolute hide into nothing after the drama, I guess, that was created in some areas regarding Ben Khan stepping away, whatever you want to call it. The sort of everything was sort of, you know, at the low point. The players, again, more drama. Their fourth coach, and to the leadership as well. He did. I'm so glad that at the end of the day, there really was only going to be one choice for the permanent coaching role. Because I think unless you basically, you know, burn the place to the ground and start again, he was the only person that probably would be able to. Otherwise, you set back the club another year. At least now with this, even the record that he's compiled over the last 12, 13 games, I think is decent. It's not great. Yeah, it's not a case of, oh, it's fantastic. Yeah, he's certainly not going to win A-League Coach of the Year based on that. But certainly he's at least instilled something that has, that at least looks like a bit of stabilisation going into this off-season, rather than what happened in 2019. Where basically he who shall not be named came in, when basically had to take the squad apart and rebuild it again. And it took them a good 6 months before they even started looking like it being a contender. I think that with good, smart recruitment, Ruben Zadkovic has a side in next season that could potentially at least, at a very, very minimum, early on could be considered top six contender if they recruit smartly.
Well, that's what I like about them signing Ruben Zadkovic as well, is it at least provides stability for a team that so desperately needs it in that role. And again, you know, I'll just play the tape recorder of me saying it how many times now, but six managers over the last two seasons, you can't have that again. However, and I've asked you both this offline, and I want to bring it online as well, and I'll preface this by saying I'm fine with them appointing Ruben Zadkovic based on the returns that we've seen in his 3 months in charge. But I'll go to you first, Scott. Should the Roar have at least inquired on some of the other available managers as well, like a certain Aurelio Vidmar, who was off contract with City, or is Paddy Cisnorbo available? Or should they have looked externally as well and at least sounded out candidates before settling on Zadkovic?
Well, we don't know that they didn't necessarily have a look at external candidates. I will say that the Aurelio Vidmar suggestion you made there, we're recording this the Monday after the elimination finals were played, and the way his coaching performance in that elimination final left a lot to be desired to me, so I wouldn't want to go down that path. But we don't know that they didn't go down that path to at least look at options. But the one thing that Ruben Zadkovic stressed consistently was stability and clarity. They were the two things he wanted to bring to the playing group, and I think Adam's right, they're the two things, that's the thing they needed the most, this group, and that was his priority to bring that in. And to then bring that in through Ruben Zadkovic and then discard him, it kind of throws all that out of the water once again. So, well, there may have been some other candidate out there who might have been a higher profile option, if you like. That surety and clarity, at least for this initial part of what is now a rebuilding situation, I think it was a really important way to go about it, because if you have to pick a coach and stick with them for a period of time, you can't just keep changing coaches all the time, because that would be 7 coaches in 18 months at that point. And at some point, you need to pick a coach and stick with them. So I can see why they just said no. Ruben Zankovic went, I think, five of his first six, or one loss in his first 6 games. I can see why they said, okay, he's got that, but he's got this playing group stable again. He's got getting some results. Let's back him in. I know they limped to the finish line a little bit, but through that first 6 weeks under Ruben Zankovic, you could see the improvement and the surety coming in to the group, and I can see why they said, no, we're just going to stick with that and going to build around it.
Adam?
I'm actually surprised that Scott backed me on this guy. But
well, was I meant to say go and get Tony Popovich or something?
Actually, I think it might have been James that was about that. No, but look,
can I
actually
just clarify?
Scott. Yeah.
I just want to clarify and say, I'm not saying they should have gone out and got Tony Popovich, but I'm just saying, would it have been worthwhile maybe just having a chat and saying, hey, Tony, you interested in coming to Brisbane? And maybe just leaking that to Marco or someone, saying the Roar sounded out external candidates before settling on Ruben Zankovic. Maybe not use the phrase worldwide search like has been used in the past, but just say we looked at other options and decided Ruben was the best man for the job.
Yeah, if that conversation happened, to be honest, I'm glad it stayed behind closed doors. But publicly facing the to me, as I said, and I will die on this hill, it was the only choice. If people care enough about this club that, you know, basically that they don't want to set it back another 6 months or a year, then, and I know that a lot of people do, because this fan base is built on, oh, we're going to only show up on when we start winning. Well, you can't just keep on setting back every time you don't like a coach, or you don't see the results immediately. It's instant gratification society. You know, at the end of the day, they are, and the proof was during the season that you could see that they were building to something. The way they played the game was great. The only thing that was missing is that they struggled to score goals, and that can be fixed. But that can be fixed through recruitment when the time is right, which is the off season. And it is such an important time. And if they don't get it right, then the clock is ticking on Ruben Zankovic as far as, you know, how long. I reckon he's got another year before you start saying he's really under pressure, unless something catastrophically goes wrong. But I just think that, yeah, for my mind, there was only one choice. If those discussions were happening, you know what? That's not for the public space.
And now at the end of the season, you can see the direction that they are going to go, and Ruben Zankovic has changed the team's style slightly in terms of the way he wants the team to go, and he's been very, very open and transparent in what he wants this team to look like going forward. And now with that stability and clarity through the coaching group into the playing roster for next season, we said on the show a couple of weeks ago, the coaching setup has already been confirmed, not just Ruben Zankovic, but his assistants and support team are all locked in and ready to go for the new season. It is now an opportunity for that, for Ruben and the rest of that group and Kaz and Zach to go, right, what do we need? And we'll get to it later in the show, but what do we need? We need this position, and this position, let's go do it. And Adam's right. The recruitment will determine where the improvement is and how much improvement there is. But at least now you can see the direction that they're going in. And through everything they've been through this year of 4 coaches, to at the end of that, to have a clear direction, that's at least something to build on. Or build with, I should say.
It's a starting point. And you're right. Like, this is all just me asking questions for the sake of causing arguments, but
because we're a discussion show, so I've got no problem with that.
but yeah, that's where I keep coming back to, saying, like, just from a way to instill some confidence, it wouldn't have been the worst thing to maybe just get it out and say, yeah, we looked at other options and Ruben was the best candidate for the job. But that is also just me nitpicking. So that was the main story of the season for the Brisbane Roar men's team. It was mass coaching changes, and I think the B storyline for me was the return to Suncorp Stadium, and just like the results on the field, as much fun as it was seeing the Roar back at Suncorp Stadium, I think it was a bit of a failure going back. I think the crowds did not justify the returns. I think, was it you posted the numbers there, Scott? The average attendance, 6,709. up from 5,626 last year. I don't know if you have the Redcliffe averages all up, but without, you know, going too far, say an extra 2,000 people for most games at Suncorp compared to 4,500 going to Redcliffe, I don't think that justifies the cost. And for a club that is, like, quite open about the fact that they're not always the most financially well off, I think they didn't get the crowds to make the move back to Suncorp a success. But, you know, hopefully this is where Australians, being a fickle sporting nation, that's where people might start to discover, like, the results start to bring crowds back next season. But, yeah, that's just where I keep landing on it as well, where, yeah, it's a lose-lose situation as well because of the amount of people turned off by Redcliffe. I know it was much less than ideal for a lot of people, but I'm not sure Suncorp was the mass improvement that it otherwise could have been, Adam.
No, it wasn't. And the trends are there, and you could make an argument sort of, you know, by metrics to say, look, there was an improvement. But look, I agree with you, James, that improvement is not enough to justify the cost that would have been from going from Redcliffe to Suncorp Stadium, the so-called convenience sort of notion that having a central sea would actually increase attendances. It did increase attendances, so they weren't lying. Just the amount of increase is probably not good. They probably weren't helped by weather, as we know, and we sort of say that unfortunately. And this is not just a shot at Brisbane sporting fans, but this is across the country. It's almost like they'll find any excuse, reason not to go to games, be it the time, the weather, the, you know, the transport situation, you know, family situation, work stuff, whatever. So look, maybe that's it, and maybe in a year's time we look at the numbers again. If there's year-on-year improvement, you can at least say, okay, it's starting to work. But at the moment, I would still say that it's probably a fail at the moment as far as whether it was worth it. But then again, at least it's an improvement on last season.
Yeah, well, that is actually probably the one point that is worth making as well, where I think that first game against Sydney, the first home game against Sydney, I don't think it rained or stormed. I think maybe it rained, but it wasn't disruptive. Next home game against Perth, it was stinking hot. And then we had mass storms for the Wanderers game, the Mariners game just before Christmas. I think the first five home games all had some form of weather disruption coming through as well, which was really not what you want. And again, not to take a shot at Raw fans for only showing up in fair weather times, and I'll accept there is a major cost of living crisis going on as well, so maybe spending $100 across ticket, transport if you drive, food, drinks, especially if you're bringing kids who, you know, can't go get cheap drinks at Hotel LA beforehand or whatever it's called now. But it is one of those things that suddenly becomes a much tougher thing to justify if you haven't got $100 to spend every fortnight, Scott.
It is. That's another factor, no doubt about that. I will have a slightly different view to both of you in terms of was it worth it. I actually think it was in terms of the growth in the numbers. I know last year it was 5,626 up there in Redcliffe, but that was also, that number includes the three games at Suncorp as well, which were the three highest drawing games of that season. The crowds in Redcliffe were about 4,000 to 5,000. The crowds at Suncorp were 6,500 to 7,000. So there is a improvement there. You also have to ask the question, with everything that happened this year, if they were still in Redcliffe, what would the crowds have been? Because I don't think they would have been as strong this year in Redcliffe as they were at Suncorp. So that's the other thing you have to look at of, was it worth it? It probably was. Is it enough to justify long-term being at Suncorp? I don't think so. If you're at 6,500 to 7,000, you need more than that to make that venue viable, both from a financial capacity and also the match day experience capacity. 6,000 or 7,000 people in a 50,000-seat stadium, it just isn't enough to generate the atmosphere the way you want it to be in terms of getting it back to where it was. So, yeah, it's a good first step, but there's still some work to be done around that space in terms of the attendances and the match day product, if you like, in terms of getting it back to where it was in 20, 16, 17, 18 when the crowds were at their absolute best. The early days of the John Aloisi era, they were when the crowds were probably at their strongest in terms of the consistent numbers, and it'll take a while to get back to that, but this is the first step on that path. I will say the only numbers you can really compare to, you've got to go back 5 years, which was the season where John Aloisi started off and it finished with Darren Davies. The average that year was 9,630 at Suncorp. So that every year after that, obviously, there was the pandemic and off to Redcliffe. So that's how far back you have to go to find a full season at Suncorp and trying to get a comparison, apples-to-apples crowd comparison. So 6,709 this year is not too bad for a first year back, but you are right. Next year, you would want that number to be much closer to 10.
If we're led to believe what Chris Fong said before he left, that the deal was renegotiated with Stadiums Queensland and the stadium management, that the cost, it was not as great as it was back previously. There was always the rumour slash sort of impression that 15,000 was a break-even number. So that, I think that number actually has come down significantly. It might be closer to 10. So to just follow on from Scott's point, if the average back last time was 9,600, if the club can get back to that sort of number on an average, I think that's going to be a lot better deal, and we're at the point where the club could start actually saying that, you know, I don't think it's ever profitable. I think unfortunately the word profitable and A-League don't go in the same sentence at the moment, but certainly break even to the point where they're not hemorrhaging money.
Well, on that as well, I think in terms of rental, I would hope that the deal has been renegotiated as well, and I'm not going to go on a rant about the quality of the pitch, but based on what was served up following those concerts and whatnot, you would hope that the Roar aren't being charged full freight for the stadium, because it was after the doubleheader with the Indigenous jerseys, those games against Perth and Adelaide, the Adelaide team, especially for the A-League Women's, came out and were just going off about the state of the pitch. It is something that you have to consider as well, where you are in a venue share situation, so you might have to be playing a few days after Pink does a show or after the Reds are packing down several scrums. But yeah, I do want to come back to, I've got a couple more points to make on this, but go to you quickly, Scott, while we're on this topic.
Yeah, I mean, look, I don't really want to get into the state of the Suncorp Stadium playing success. We went through that enough throughout the season. It wasn't good enough in the beginning, and we'll leave it at that. But the other thing is, Adam kind of hinted at the league-wide profitability. I was going to say, what are the league-wide crowds looking like? Because, yeah, Brisbane's crowds might be, 6,500 to 7,000 on average, but compared to the rest of the competition, look at where some of the other major markets are around the country. The crowds aren't exactly the headline factor. We'll get to a league-wide recap later. Crowds are not the thing that you look at as the big tick for the A-League, so it's not just a Brisbane problem that the crowds aren't necessarily where they were 5 years ago. It's a whole league issue, and something that the whole competition has to look at going forward, not just Brisbane Roar.
For sure. I will say the two other silver linings that I think you can take out of the move back to Suncorp as well, though. One, I think the Den was back in full force as well.
Yes.
Even though there were some issues with Suncorp Stadium customer service, security, QPS, which
it wouldn't be the Dem without those issues. That's almost an annual thing. So, but just to interject, well done to the Dem. It's probably one of the few positive sides that come out of moving back to Suncorp.
Well, and the other thing that I would say as well, and this probably contributed to the Dem as well, is we got a return for the Thursday night, Friday night kickoff times. I think we had maybe three or four regularly scheduled weeknight kickoffs up in Redcliffe, and that was largely because getting up to Redcliffe on a Thursday or Friday night after work kind of sucks. You get the gateway motorway traffic and or just trying to go along Gippy Road or however Adam gets there from his shire, but you've got, like, getting those Thursday and Friday night games back was great. Admittedly, not so much when you had the massive thunderstorms bearing down an hour before kickoff, but those, like, games under floodlights really did make a difference as well. So it wasn't all bad, but I just think in terms of the return to Suncorp, it would have been nice if those crowds were even just closer to 8,500, 9,000, especially considering the number of comments that we got that we kept seeing online saying, if the Raw go back to Suncorp, I'll start showing up to games. And I know for a fact that quite a few of those people didn't show up to a single game this season because it was too rainy, too hot, or too Friday. Anyway, we should probably do a league-wide season recap as well. There are still four teams remaining, three weekends of matches. But just quickly as well, we'll just go around the horn and go, Adam, what was your big positive from the A-League across the board this season?
For the A-League, if we're talking A-Leagues, plural, the A-League women. The numbers and metrics that, at least, there may not be much legacy as far as, you know, infrastructure goes from the Women's World Cup, but certainly the crowds, it may be not the boom that some predicted, but certainly there was strong growth in women's football, and no more important than being Female Football Week as well. That underscores the importance of that. But that's probably been the positive, is the A-League women's definitely a boom year. Probably still a long way to go as far as those where they want to go. But I think that was probably the positive for that. There wasn't, in a year where there probably wasn't too many positives, unfortunately there's a lot more negatives that overshadowed the leagues in general.
Scott?
Apart from Adam mentioned the positive of the year was the A-League Women's, I'll go for a different one just for some variety. It was the on-field product. The on-field product was really, really good. Every team had players that they looked at and thought, there's a real player there, and the teams on the field were actually really, really strong. Even the last place teams, apart from the final day with Perth, they were pretty good across the board, all 12 teams in the A-League men and in the women's as well. They were all quite competitive, and that was the real positive thing. And there were some really good young players who got their chance and really showed what they could do, and that's the direction of the A-League's going forward. That's the really big positives, and that was genuinely the positive. Off the field, there were a lot of issues. We might get to them in a minute, but you had all sorts of issues around financial concerns for certain teams. Teams finally being sold, actually the sale of Perth, and it seems like the Newcastle situation as well. Those two things being cleared up were also positives, but there was so much of those other things away from the field over this season, James, that the positive, thankfully on the field at least, when the games were being played, the product was really, really compelling. We had a great premiership race right down to the final game of the season, so there was something about the league on the field. If you could get past all the problems away from that, that made it quite compelling to watch.
Yeah, and I think that's probably where I'm landing as well in terms of the biggest positive, which is the complete and utter chaos and unpredictability of it. That's what we want. Like, I love seeing teams chase down a benchmark, and seeing Melbourne City get knocked off in back-to-back grand finals was great, but it's also a lot of fun tuning in every week going, geez, who's actually going to win? Now, some of that came down to just dysfunction at certain clubs from Western Sydney, but you've also got a lot of teams that just decided, nah, you know what, we're going to win this week. And it's come through in spades as well, especially with the Mariners and Wellington setting the pace, and that's been the most enjoyable part of the season for me. However, as we've alluded to, it wasn't all roses. There were quite a lot of dramas, and I think, actually, one other positive I do want to mention as well, Melbourne victory. The way they brought in that violinist for the last two Melbourne derbies was phenomenal. And just a cool little introduction. And I think it just shows that there is still so much that this league can do as long as they are willing to maybe look outside the box and go into that untapped potential as well. I mean, the Mariners, their Coast football commentary team going over for the AFC Cup final as well. Each club can find these sort of unique little things to offer. And I think that's probably the way forward for all this to happen. Now the negatives. And I think it's just the lingering uncertainty over the Jets has been probably the biggest negative for me this season as well, where it would be nice to actually know who's featuring in the league next year. We were told that it would be going to 14 teams. I think the only thing we've heard out of Canberra in terms of a men's side is cricket. The uncertain future of the women's team cast a bit of a pall.
I think that's been locked in by
it has, but I mean, like, the pall that cast over at least a little while of the women's season as well, it has been really frustrating, and it has also made it really hard to be an A-League fan at times when you're trying to say, well, like, I've been hearing the A-League's dead basically since year one, game one or whatever, but there are times where those like comments do hit a little bit closer to home as well when you're starting to wonder, are these teams actually going to exist next season?
I think it was a case of that there were times there you'd almost, with all doom and gloom, it made you almost question, so what's going on? Is there going to be a league? But it always finds a way. And that's, at the end, like I said, I'll take the Canberra United one as a case in point, because it did look grim. And eventually, it did get up a help. It did get up with the help of the AC government, Senator David Pocock as well, who was really instrumental in sort of getting that government help. But with that said, it should never have come to that. I think it was Lisa Devanna that might have said it, that it is an absolute disgrace that a club like Canberra United, on the back of a Women's World Cup where the nation was focused on football, women's football, that one of the foundation clubs and a three-time champion club could be so close to extinction because of negligence. Well, not negligence is not the right word, but the whole complacency and sort of, just not having a plan for Canberra United. So, and that was sort of, reflected across the board on a lot of things. So, it's, again, as you said, James, you always hear the rhetoric of, the A-League is dead or the A-League is dying. It's never going to die, but unfortunately, at the moment, it's in an induced coma.
Yeah, it's in a holding pattern which just goes round in circles, and off the field there are still a lot of things to get right. The Newcastle situation, as much as it sounds like it's positive and heading in the right direction, that still needs to be resolved sooner rather than later so that they can actually start to build going forward. The Canberra situation is still up in the air. I'm at the point where I think it's going to be a 13-team season team next year in the A-League men's competition, because I think Auckland, obviously, they're coming in and we know that's locked in. Canberra's all gone quiet, so I'm just assuming at this point it's going to be at least another 12 months before we see them in the competition. Now watch when we come back on the first show next year, we're talking about Canberra being in the A-League competition, but at this point I think we're going to delay that one another year. And it's interesting because the product is so good on the field, just got to get everything right away from the field. That was kind of the situation 20 odd years ago when the old league shut down and the A-League began. It was the product was never the problem. It was all the issues away from that and getting it right and getting people's attention back on the sport and what was there. And when that happened in the early days of the A-League, the crowds were there and there was a real buzz around it. It's almost like we've got to go back to the future again. Not necessarily shut everything down and restart a whole new competition, but that mindset of, right, the product is really good on the field. How do we get people to support that and in the stands and build that good feeling again off the field? That's the challenge, and it is a real challenge because it's the summer sporting landscape here, James, has changed completely. There was a point a few years ago where day leagues were looking like they were going to challenge cricket to be the major summer sport in this country. Now, they've obviously kicked well clear with what they do, both their local, their domestic competitions and their international stuff. But you look at the NBL, their crowds and their attendances aren't too far away from the A-Leagues as well. So you've got real competition in the summer sporting market here in Australia. So there's some real challenges here for the A-League to do that. But I think you've got to go back to what was the overarching desire when the A-League first began to draw people's attention into the sport. And that's where they have to get back to. That focus of what they did in those first couple of years. Maybe that's a bit of a blueprint of where need to go back to.
Yeah, and I think it needs to go, I'm going to sound like a wanky LinkedIn manager post or something, but it's back to basics. Just get the football there, try and encourage active support, because that is easily what sets football apart. But I think the problem is also when you're encouraging people to be a little bit wilder than they might be going to a NRL game or something, or showing controlled enthusiasm, that can sometimes be an oxymoron. You know, those two things do cancel each other out. But you've got all the elements there. It's just somebody needs to try and just find a way to actually focus it all rather than give it that scattergun approach of let's do this, let's do that. And, you know, I suppose what I'm hoping for is for next season alone is you can just get back to where you were at the end of the 2018-19 season. Because things were going all right. It wasn't perfect. But obviously then you had the pandemic. Then you had essentially a litany of gambles by the APL that just completely blew up in their faces as well. And, you know, if one or two of those things do work out, then it's an incredibly different story. But, you know, the I suppose the one thing that I will say about Danny Townsend is he at least went into his tenure running the APL with plenty of confidence in his product. Maybe too much confidence in his product, as it turns out, but, you know, a lot of those things wound up backfiring, things didn't work out, and now here we are. But either way. All right, we'll do the brief discussion of the other 11 clubs, but I'm actually going to do it in a bit of a Q&A form rather than go bang, 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 different clubs. So let's start with you, Scott.
Uh-oh.
Which of the other 12 clubs should have the most optimism for season 2024-25?
That's a great question, because it's a very, very interesting one. I think teams like Central Coast and Wellington have real cause for optimism in terms of what they're doing, not just in the men's space, but the women's as well. Both of those programs have gotten better. In the women's, Central Coast Mariners have been phenomenal in their first season, no doubt about that. They were the story, one of the stories of the other women's season, to be a start-up team into the finals, following the footsteps of Western United. So Central Coast have such optimism going forward. They were also crowned AFC Cup champions overnight, so congratulations to Central Coast on that one. So they've got great optimism going forward as well. Back in the Champions League next year, we'll see what they can do there. Wellington having a derby for the first time, looking forward. That's going to be one of the big storylines of next year, is how that New Zealand derby resonates. We know how it's going to go in New Zealand. It's going to be their biggest game of the year. How it resonates in this country will be very, very interesting. So they've got a lot to look forward to. And then you look at teams like Perth and Brisbane, and maybe potentially Newcastle if they do, once that gets resolved. Ownership situation sorted. Coaching situation sorted. Let's see how you can build. They're the teams who have optimism going forward. I think everybody else is kind of in a situation where they're already in a cycle where they're going okay, but Central Coast and Wellington with some big fixtures to look forward to, and those other three teams having the opportunity to build, they're the fan bases with some potential for some optimism going forward.
Right, so Scott's taken half the league. Adam, what about you?
Adam can have all the Sydney and Melbourne teams, because I think that's all anyone's going to mention.
And actually, I will say as well, it just took 8 years, but you finally said that's a good question.
I'll note down to one, Central Coast Mariners. I think that they have got the blueprint down on how to rebuild quickly, get money in, and go again. And I think what Mark Jackson has built in, and what Richard Peel, the club chairman, has built that club. I think Sean Millichamp leaving as CEO is probably a bit of a downside. So you hope that the new CEO can sort of, you know, stick to the same blueprint. But I think there's so much going well for Central Coast Mariners at the moment. I think it is the success story, that the smallest budget in the league, the little club that could, and they're really showing the way. I also think, just as a smoky, what are Adelaide United going to do with all the money they're going to get for Nesta Ranakunda and a couple of the other sales as well? How will they actually spend it? What will they do? And whether that can translate into mere success, or whether it's more of an investment for a couple of years' time. Because they've got a couple of good young players still there. They're about to come through and break through in South Australia.
All right. Well, I'm going to take the next team off my rankings list. And I'm going to say Western United. I think that through a bit of, you know, force majeure, they had to debut quite a few young players this season. They've got their facility up and running now, and I think that is going to turn into a fairly solid home ground advantage over the year as well. And It sounds like John Aloisi is going to be sticking around, famous last words. But yeah, I think Western United have a lot to look forward to going forward as well. And look, since you guys all doubled down as well, I think MacArthur are actually building something as well. It's not going to set the world alight the way the Wanderers did in their first few seasons, but I think they've got a little something there. Something to work with, at least.
You know, stability.
Yeah, exactly. And that's something going for them as well. Team of the Year, well, I'm just going to take Central Coast because, damn it, they're doing really, really well at the moment. Premiers, AFC Cup champions, and quite well positioned to make another A-League Grand Final and possibly win it all. Now let's go back to the Brisbane Roar. And, well, we did announce the player of the season on the last show, didn't we, Adam?
We did, yes.
Jay O'Shea. All right, so some of the key numbers for this season. Scott, I'll let you read them out since you're the one that went to the effort of compiling them.
Okay, so I'll read them out. So that's 30 players over the course of the season, which was the exact same number they used in the previous season. There were a few milestones. Tom Aldridge, Scott Neville and Kai Truan all made their 100th appearance for the Brisbane Roar. I think Scott Neville actually came during that Australia Cup final against Sydney FC back right at the start of the year. And Joe Coletti, Macklin Freak, Henry Hoare, Nikola Mladenovic and Louis Zabala all clocked up 50 games for the club over the course of the season as well. And there were 10 debutants, James, which we might talk about in a moment, some of those players. A couple of them had starring roles, players like Tom Waddingham, Florian Berenguer, Marco Rojas at the end. Others were a little bit more sparingly used, like James Nikolowski, Quinn McNichol, Nathan Geyer made his debut as well. So there were a mixture there, but 10 debutants over the course of the season. And looking at that list now, the thing that strikes me the most is a lot of young players from the academy. Almost 50% of those are players who are from the youth team, and that's quite a story as well.
And you also look at that list as well, and you think, I would say probably 6 or 7 of those guys, barring a transfer offer coming in, are going to be back day one of preseason.
Yeah, it's, well, like I said, it's hard to know, but even if the one big shining light as far as the rising young players that debuted this season being Tom Waddingham, I still think, yeah, that certainly there's still a lot left in the sort of reserve for the academies. I think that whatever happens, barring major injury, Quinn McNichol is only going to get better. He's only 16 years old. Same with Ryland Brownlee. So they're two players I think that could be potentially the future of the club if they are managed correctly. James Nikolowski as well, I think that he, and we're going to go about it, you know, about later, about what the Roar need, but he next season is going to become so important unless they really sort of, you know, recruit around him. But overall, yeah, it was good to see that, you know, a number of young players did get a chance, and also young players.
Yeah, it does. And actually, just while you were bringing that up, Adam, I managed to go and find the very rough Raw squad list that I've been able to assemble off Scott's contract readings, I guess, off the press releases and whatnot. And I'm looking at the team for next season, assuming we're going to see something similar to that 4-3-3 setup that Zadkovic used all season. I think the areas that the Raw still really have to look at addressing are the two central defenders, because it sounds like Aldred and Truan are leaving. Scott Neville will be coming off an injury. They're going to need probably another starting level central midfielder, maybe more defensive focused, and a pair of wingers, because it sounds like a couple of the notable ones are off contract. Does that sound about right to you, Scott?
Yeah, I didn't realize we're already up to that part of the show, but yeah, that's the areas of need. The central defensive combination has to be resolved. At least one of those two are moving on, probably both. There's a hole in midfield that needs to be filled as well, and then there's that front third where there just hasn't been enough goals and creativity all season long. They need a spark in those areas. So in all lines of the team, other than goalkeeper, some reinforcements are needed. Not just reinforcements, but some real quality added in all three areas to boost the team from where they are to where they want to get to.
Adam?
Yeah, I agree. Central defence is a huge issue now. Tom Aldred confirmed he's leaving. There's very strong rumours that Kai Truan is leaving as well. So that there's two starting centre-backs they've got to cover. Scott Neville is probably not going to be back till you know, next year the earliest, if he does come back after his ACL. As I said, James Nikolovsky, all of a sudden he needs to become potentially at least a dependable option, if not a starting centre back. And also as well, they probably need an out and out number nine. They need a creative forward or a attacking number 10. That spine of the team needs to be rebuilt.
Well, this is how I've sort of examined it based on what we know in terms of who's contracted for next season. And I know one of these names you guys are going to both jump at, but if they had to play a game day one of preseason, which thankfully they don't, but I feel like
it's day three of preseason and they play in the cup.
But you've got Macklin Freak as your goalkeeper. Your fullbacks are going to be Jack Hingett and Corey Brown. Neville would be one of the starting centre-backs if healthy. Otherwise, you're probably looking at James Nikolovsky and Ryan Lethlean as your two options. Your central midfield will be Coletti, O'Shea and Berenguer, with Quinn McNichol off the bench. Your wingers are probably going to be Ryland Brownlee and Anthony Burke-Gilroy, with Waddingham leading the line. So that's in terms of just what you got. Then you'd also have McNichol and a couple of the youth players on the bench, as far as we're aware. So I think the areas that they will want to look to add experience, leadership and whatnot there as well. The name that leaps out off the, again, to the best of our knowledge, off-contract players that I want to see them bring back would be Henry Hoare. I think he's got to be priority one now in terms of the next re-signing announcement. Scott? Sound fair?
Yeah. If Henry Hoare has not got a contract for next year, that would be priority number one of the players who, to our understanding of what's publicly available, and look, I mean, Bruce and Roy might listen to this saying, they don't know what they're talking about because this player's signed.
This player's signed.
We can only work with what we have publicly available. And he is the one attacking wide player, if you like, this year, who was a consistent threat all season long. So he would be the absolute priority number one of the players that, to our understanding, are off contract, other than Kai Truan. If they could potentially somehow get Kai Truan to say, that would be another huge re-signing, but they're the two you'd look at and say, if they can keep those two, that would be really important, but particularly Henry Hoare, given how well he's done in that front third, he's the one.
Yep, and I think he also just provides that dynamic presence that can possibly help rejig that midfield as well, because he can sort of play in that central attacking role and just provide a bit of cover for Berenguer, who wasn't the healthiest this year, Adam.
No, but Florian Berenguer as well is getting on in age, and it's questionable whether he is as effective as he was for Melbourne City. But you know, so far the time does catch up. But I think he also provides in other areas that is not measured by statistics or on the pitch. But I agree. Henry Hoare is almost a must sign. If the process at the moment is to re-sign, if he hasn't already signed, let's hope he has. But other than that, it's that's a team that you read out that you'd still think that should be able to be competitive through the early rounds of the Australia Cup, irrespective who they play. Their bench might be a bit lean, but then again, the MPL side, there's some really good young diamonds in that side that are just waiting to be unearthed. So you just never know. You give these kids an opportunity, you just never know what you could come up with.
Yeah, and that's what you're certainly going to be hoping for. You look at signing those players that can sort of come in and start 25 games and whatnot, but you think about that midfield as well, and again, you can just copy and paste it from the last couple of seasons. I think they need to work out what J. O'Shea is actually going to be this season coming, because his versatility is almost going to be his biggest hindrance, because sometimes he was playing as that deep-lying midfielder, sometimes he was playing as the lead attacker. I think he's best suited in that sort of hybrid role where he's not the main defensive option. He was getting coverage from someone like Gamulka, or in that out-and-out attacking role as well, where he can just sort of pull the strings. But yeah, I think they need to make sure that they find someone that can really unlock those attacking players as well. Adam? Well, actually, no, Scott. I went to Adam before.
Well, on Jarrod Sher, he will be 36 when the new season begins in September. So you have to, or October, whenever the new season does begin. So you have to look at it and say, should the Raw build the full midfield around Jarrod Sher like they have for the last 5 years? Or does he now become a cog in that midfield where it's not purely around him all of the time? There's other pieces in that midfield who can carry the load, and he can do what he does and just focus on that, because that transition also does need to happen at some point. You can't be reliant on JOJ all of the time, every game going forward. In my mind, he has to become still a really important part of the midfield, but not the central cog of the midfield looking forward.
I think they've already answered that question, Scott, in terms of providing alternate options for JOJ when they signed Berenguer at the start of the season to try and provide that extra creative outlet, and then they doubled and almost tripled down on that in their mid-season signings, bringing in Keegan Yelicic on loan, who, by the way, wouldn't be opposed to bringing him back next season if that can be arranged, and Marco Rojas, who was a nice guy when I spoke to him on the sideline, but wasn't ever really healthy enough to make an impact. But I think that really did answer your question, Scott, in terms of what they want to do with their playmakers. You give yourself that attacking midfield trio in front of O'Shea of, say, Yelicic, Hoare and Berenguer. That's pretty damn good, I'd say.
It also kind of answers Adam's question of how they want him to play going forward. All of these other creative attacking number 10 types, it almost suggests that Jay O'Shea's role now is going to be a slightly deeper role in midfield, not necessarily as a number 6, but as a deeper lying playmaking role, if you like. Not necessarily pushing forward. Pushing forward all of the time, picking his moments and inserting himself into the game where he can have maximum effect. I think that seems to be the role he's taking up, and it's a good transition in the midfield, if you like.
Yeah, exactly. And I think it is going to help O'Shea thrive as the season goes on as well, because he still looks like he's in pretty solid shape as well. So it's not like he's fading away as the year goes on, but you also don't want to discover in, say, late February that, oh, we've run him into the ground, and he just can't respond the way that he used to. So that's kind of where the squad is at overall. Looking in terms of recruitment, there's no shortage of players that are reportedly set to hit the market in the coming month, I think, a few weeks, whatever it is.
End of June. The official end of contract dates of most A-League players.
Okay, so there have been some names linked to the Raw already. Ibasuki, Van der Sarg, Ben Halloran, etc. But the question I'm looking at Scott's list now, and are there any names of the off-contract players that leap out above all else? Because there are a couple, especially from that Mariners team, that I'd be making an approach to as well. And I was going to ask you guys to guess, but just while you're bringing that up on your own devices, I would be opposed to making a run at Dan Hall and bringing him back as that central defensive option as well. Scott, what do you think about that?
He would be a terrific addition, there's no doubt about that. And look, there are some very interesting players off contract across the A-Leagues. It's also probably going to be the most interesting off-season for quite a while in terms of player movement, because there's so many storylines. We're focusing on the Brisbane Roar here, where they need to have a rebuild of some key positions throughout the team. Other clubs like Newcastle and Perth have now got the ownership situation sorted, are going to look to be doing the same thing. Melbourne City's doing a big rebuild now under Aurelio Vidmar, and Auckland, of course, need a full squad as well. They need to sign 20-odd players. So there's some interesting players. You mentioned Dan Hall for one. He would be a terrific addition, the former Western Pride defender. He could fill that centre-back role, no doubt about that. Even somebody like Ibasuki, as you said, up front, 15 goals in the season, he will be a hot commodity as well. But there's going to be some real competition out there, James, for a lot of these players, and it's going to be interesting because I think there's going to be some real interesting moves across the competition.
I've got my wish list of three for the Raw going into next season. I'm going to say Dan Hall for one, help shore up that defence. I'm going to go big and say Oscar Zavada. I think he's the sort of player that you need. And I would also look at raiding the Melbourne Victory ranks. I've sort of gone back and forth on this as well, but Eli Adams, I think you've got to bring him back. I think he was the best of that group that came through a few years ago, and if you can come in and offer him regular game time, I think he's certainly capable of taking that next step as well. I was tossing up between him and Jake Brimmer, but I'm going to favour the local kid. Adam, have you got any sort of wish list?
Look, it's difficult because there's links everywhere. Like I said previously, I don't think Ibasuki's coming. I think he re-signed with Adelaide United. A player like a Josh Nisbet, he's rumored to go in Melbourne City. Max Ballard apparently is going overseas to Central Coast's sister club in Portugal. So there's a lot of movements, and India as well has obviously as well become a major sort of departure point. That's the rumour where Tom Aldridge's headed. Rumoured as well that perhaps Jamie McLaren might go. So
Curtis Good apparently as well.
Yeah. So if there's one player if we're playing the wish game that hasn't been already linked elsewhere, it's still sort of in limbo, Oscar Zavada for me is the one that I'm wanting. I every time I've seen him live playing for Wellington, I've just been taken as a player. So I would love to see him in a Brisbane Roar kit, but it's going to be tough and it's going to cost money.
If we are playing the wishlist game, Zavada would be ideal in terms of a centre forward. He's got everything you would want to be a focal point of an attacking lineup that you're rejigging, and that would work really, really well. Even that Marcelo from Western Sydney as a defender, as a 1 or 2 year option, if you're bringing through a young defender alongside him, could be a really good leader at the back as well. So players like that, and even if it doesn't turn out to be someone like Dan Hall, maybe slightly further up the F3 or M1, whatever it's called these days, something like Phil Cancer at the back as well for Newcastle could be a really nice addition as well. So there are some good young players you can bring in, but all these players we're mentioning will probably be the same players that every other club around the country are looking at as well. So there's going to be a real high price put on players like that this season, James.
I know James would like Carl Jenkinson to come, so...
No, yeah. James wants Nathan Constantopoulos to return to the Roar and other difficult names he's had pronouncing over the years.
Yeah, that was great on that first show, reading the list and going, ooh, that's going to need a bit of practice. But actually, well, I can safely say a couple of these names you can definitely cross off in terms of players that the Roar are going to be interested in for off-field reasons. But just looking at this list as well, one, it is really confusing seeing Danny Da Silva and Damian Da Silva and remembering that they're not the same player. And secondly,
Damian, thanks.
Yep. And secondly, as well, the players that are off contract in 12 months, I don't think they're necessarily off. Completely forgot what I was going to say there, but I don't think you can cross them off as well. I think some of them who might be playing bit part roles at their current clubs, you might be able to make a run at. But those are the three names that sort of jump out to me in terms of what we want for the Roar for next season.
I don't want to repeat my rant about the domestic transfer system not being in place.
Yeah, but so we'll just keep moving.
I'll say this: it does make it difficult to predict these things when basically the only list you've got is either the worldwide scouting list of players we've never heard, but don't play in this league, or the free agents. Whereas if you had the DTS, you can basically pick and choose and say, okay, it's going to cost you a bit of money, but we can get what we actually need rather than what's left. And I think that should be a frustration across the league, not just Brisbane Roar, but especially where Brisbane Roar has certain positions they need to fill. The fact that looking at that list and going, oh, geez, there's bugger all options at centre-back, or there's not many options for striker, because that's who's free. You either go overseas, whereas at least then, if you've got the money and backing behind you, you can basically pick anyone. So I think it's just another frustration why the league is stunted as far as the movement of players and being able to build squads that basically are built for what their requirements are. It's because of that huge restriction of you just cannot bid, or you cannot get access to those players who are actually under contract, even if it means, you know, raiding the piggy bank to get to them.
That's going to be one of my questions. As we've seen every couple of years in the A-League, there's one club who try and go out and bring in the big name the former Premier League star or the former international player, and with the rise of Saudi Arabia and the MLS being as strong, do you reckon there'll be anyone trying it on that path this year to any success? Because I'm sure someone will try it, but I don't know how much success they'll have given the way the global market has changed so significantly, even in the last 18 months, given how much money is coming out of Saudi now.
Perth. It'll be Perth with their connections through Vinnie Grella and company as well. They'll pick someone out of Italy.
Fabio Grosso. No, he's retired now. He's coaching, actually.
Yeah. Well, there you go. New
coach. The Italian Olympic diving team. Is that what he's coaching?
Oh, hey.
Anyway. Yeah. All right.
Let's not mention the war.
I'll throw a couple of names at you. Very quick yes or no game, because then I think we might have to wrap this up. So let's start. I'll just throw some names out there as well. Let's go with, starting with Adelaide. Would you be interested in Johnny Yule?
Yes, but I think he's head overseas. He's a tremendous young prospect. So I would say yes, but I don't think he's coming.
Scott?
Anywhere other than Adelaide.
No.
All right. Well, Central Coast have already gone Dan Hall. What about Miguel DiPizio? Scott?
No.
Adam?
Do you want an explanation on these? Or
no.
A simple yes or no?
Simple yes or no, because I am conscious of time.
Yes.
And actually, I will say from here on out, assume Tom Waddingham has been sold.
Okay,
so what about for MacArthur? Would you take Danny De Silva? Adam?
No.
Scott?
No, Quinn McNichol's going to play those minutes next year. No.
I'll stick with MacArthur. Matt Miller. Scott?
I'm a big fan of Matt Miller, but I've signed a lot of fullbacks already, yeah. So I don't know if there's a spot for him.
Yeah, no, because we've got fullbacks.
All right, what about... there's no one really that jumps out off Melbourne City as a easy option. But
they don't sell anybody.
Well, I'm just looking at the off-contract list and trying to find some names. Let's say, Adam, would you take Andrew Naboo?
No.
Scott?
No.
All right, let's go victory. Jake Brimmer. Scott?
I would, but it sounds like he's already committed elsewhere, if you believe the rumours, but he's a really good player.
Yeah, well, just play along, Adam.
I am. I said I would.
despite being a former Liverpool Academy player, yes, but I agree with Scott. He's apparently off to Auckland.
He's a former Liverpool player? No.
I don't know, change your mind.
All right, let's go Newcastle. Adam, would you take Reno Piscopo?
Yes.
Scott?
Probably would. That's an area where there's some improvement needed. He could be an X-Factor player.
I'm trying to look at some names for Perth, because obviously they've got the... I'll skip Perth, because there's a few names there that I think might actually wind up coming through based on Zadkovic's time there.
Daryl Lachman, yes.
Yeah. Let's go Sydney FC.
Out of sufferance.
Now, skip Sydney as well. Actually, yeah, no one worthwhile in Sydney.
Luke Bratton's off to MacArthur, allegedly.
Yep. And also, well, I'm also not entirely sure after the last time the Raw tried to sign him.
I only bring him up because that will always come up, is that, oh, Luke Bratton's available, oh, we need to get him back to Brisbane. No. Because he's got him, Carver.
How about Brandon Borello?
If you could get Brandon Borello at his best, it could be very, very interesting. But I'm interested to see if he stays in the A-League at all. He might have opportunities elsewhere.
I thought he signed a long-term extension with them, like 2 years or something.
I could be wrong. I'm just going off Scott's list here, so...
Yeah, no. It's directed at my esteemed colleague, but...
I have to consult Dr. Google on that one once.
Yeah, no, I thought he resigned for 2 years, but if that's his, but just for the sake of the game, absolutely, I'd take him. He's like I said, he's a Socceroo.
Whoa, there's a headline. Adam says yes, bring back a former Raw player. That's a headline in and of itself.
It took 8 years.
But like I said, I'll make exceptions, and Brandon Bry is one. We may as well get the whole band back, but he's off to the Middle East or India.
Yeah, and there's one other name there that I know you'll both say yes to from Western United, Daniel Pena.
Funnily enough, I'm a no. Again, with Berenguer under contract and McNichol, you don't really need that creative central number 10 type. It's more the wide areas that you need to fill in. So I think that's more the priority than the 10. I think, again, Berenguer is going to be the starter. You want McNichol to take a step forward next year. You can't keep crowding that area. So as good a player as Peña is, I don't see where the fit is. Unless somebody's leaving.
Fair enough. Adam?
As a player, yes. But look, I actually agree with Scott. You've got also back who you've got here, because if you keep on transplanting players in, you're never going to get anywhere, and you just push out players that, you know, potentially could fill that role. So I don't think the Royal can afford him as well. There are bigger. They need the money elsewhere to fill other positions, and that's probably a position that they've got covered. At least see for what Peña will be asking for.
Yeah. All right, Scott, last
Adam
thought.
Was right, by the way. Borrello has signed through 2027. So you can completely forget that one 100%.
Okay, so you gave us incomplete information to work with. I'm done.
See ya.
Yeah, I've got to go and update that, clearly, don't I?
All right, let's go through the season predictions.
Oh, no.
Just quickly.
We really have to.
Just quickly.
That must mean James thinks he's the best because he's bringing this up.
Just
this is a party. It's a parting gift.
Yes. So we all had the Raw finishing fifth. So, hey, that was looking pretty pessimistic for a while. Winning the league, Adam had Western Sydney. I had Melbourne City, and Scott had Sydney FC. So I think that actually means Scott was nearest to the pin on that.
Oh, Rudin, we do not trust.
That is an absolute first, given last year I had Melbourne Victory winning the league and they finished nearly last. So that is absolutely almost a first.
Now,
given that Sydney finished fourth and apparently I'm closest to the pin, we never said we were experts, people.
No. Now, the premiers. Adam had the Mariners finishing sixth. Scott had them finishing eighth. And I had them finishing fourth. The Wooden Spoon is Perth. Adam had them seventh. I had them tenth. And Scott had them seventh as well. Winning the Wooden Spoon. Scott and I had Newcastle taking out the Wooden Spoon. And that giggling you can hear is Adam tipping Wellington to finish in the Wooden Spoon. Although I would wipe that smile off your face, Scott, because you weren't much better having them in 11th.
I know. That's why I'm laughing.
I would just like to say I'd like to acknowledge our football chief. In all seriousness, what Giancarlo Italiano has done with that squad, and what David Dome and his management team done at Wellington Phoenix, I think has been tremendous. And I laugh and giggle about that, but you know what? I'm glad I'm wrong on that, because they have been fantastic.
It's any consolation, we're also all on the bandwagon for the finals.
Pretty much.
Oh, yeah.
Just chaos. Give me chaos.
Up the Knicks.
All right. Well, given you've just seen what we did for predictions, I've got two to wrap this show up with, two to ask you for. First things first, will the Raw win their Australia Cup playoff? Scott?
Yes, because they're at home.
Adam?
Yes.
All right, and again, we'll just go in, and I'll say they'll win as well. We'll say, how many new signings will debut in that Australia Cup playoff as well? So not counting youth players, new signings. I'm going to say two. Well, only two will make their debut. I think there'll be a few players. I think it'll be a fairly youthful squad overall. Adam, what do you think?
I think it's going to be zero, because I don't think they're going to get players in on time. I don't think they'll have them up and running just yet. I think they'll be more for the round of 32 and beyond if they get there. So I don't think there'll be any new players outside of the academy.
Fair enough. Scott?
If there's no new players, then I'll be changing that pick to Perth. I think there'll be two, maybe three. Depending on who they sign from the A-League, those players will be in the preseason from day one. They'll be potentially in line to make a debut, and that's your answer, James. May 1 to 3, somewhere in that general vicinity.
All right. Well, that is going to be it for this.
Question three. Will we welcome James back to the show? No.
Yes, this will be the last you guys hear from me. But, yeah, that is going to be it for this edition, season, and I suppose era of the Brisbane Football Review. Yeah, it's been a very entertaining 300-odd shows over the last 8 years, but I eventually just had to take a bit more time to be with my family, and it'll be very strange listening in from the outside and wanting to scream at some of the things you guys are saying, like I do with NPL Sunday at the moment. But, yeah, I...
job.
But, yeah, I suppose... Look, I haven't actually planned out a big speech or anything because I'm trying not to make this all about me for once. But do have a few big thanks that we really should give out in the time as well. First and foremost, probably should say Adrian and the old Daily Football Show group as well for just linking us up and giving us the opportunity to launch this show in the first place and what it's become. Should say many, many, many people from both the Raw, the local NPL clubs as well, but specifically with the Raw. Mark Kingsman, who really welcomed us in the early days as well. Shane, when he was a media manager, and all of his successes. At Aaron, Angela, now Sonia. We do appreciate everything you've done, done for us as well. And, yeah, the local NPL clubs as well. Many a night on the deck at Lions, scoffing down pizza at Brisbane City. It's been a very, very memorable time doing it all, and one that I will look back very fondly on as well. I think there are way too many highlights as well. Should say big thanks to Sean as well for his support and his time at FQ and the Roar as well. I think he was our biggest cheerleader for many, many, many years. And I suppose I should just wrap up by saying thanks to both of you two, Adam and Scott. It's been great getting to know you guys over the last 8 years. I was very pleased to have you at my wedding after season one as well, and I'm very pleased to have you guys as friends. So, yeah, that's really all. Oh, and I probably should say thanks to everyone for listening and putting up with us as well over the last little while as well, because yeah, every one of you that's come up at the Raw Games and said, oh, I love listening to the show, it's been very much appreciated. And while I am stepping down as a full-time host, I can assure you there will be many, 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 many opportunities to still hear my voice. I'll be coming in as a fill-in whenever Adam goes on holiday or Scott just can't be bothered. I'll still be doing the commentary with Football Queensland as well. And, well, I seem to be talking more horse racing at my day job, which I know Adam is sitting there going, why? But, yeah, I won't be going anywhere. I'll still be involved behind the scenes as well. It's just, I can't commit the way that I need to be on this show every week. And I do appreciate you guys understanding that as well. I'm sure you'll have no problem replacing me with someone taller. And, yeah, you'll just have to find a new punching bag, I suppose, as well. But, yeah, that's pretty much all I can ramble off as well. I just want to say thank you to everyone as well. It's been a phenomenal ride. And, yeah, that's all I've got.
Yeah, that's our biggest off-season recruitment decision, Adam, is who's our new punching bag. There's no doubt about that. The show has come a long way from the studio at Yeronga, which James nearly blew up in about the fifth or sixth episode, to completely switching the way we do things from recording in person to now recording over Skype and Zoom, to thanks to the pandemic. It's come a long way, and it has been an absolutely fantastic 8 years, and we laugh and joke, James, but we have really enjoyed you being the host of this show. It's been great to do this show for the last 8 years. We were at your wedding. It was a fantastic day, and it's been great for the last 8 years, and you are always welcome back on the show, and we will have you on the show plenty of times, no doubt about that. Probably even sooner than you realise.
Yeah, I'm just doing the maths now. I'm thinking the Australia Cup preview is going to be coming off sooner rather than later.
Yeah, it's we joke, and now we give each other our time, but you know, I think it words sort of, you know, can't express how much, you know, James, that you've meant to this show. It has been a group effort, and while it won't be the same, we always strive to be to evolve and to move on, and all we can say is, you know, thank you for, you know, for the 8 years that you have, that for all of us, that, you know, this is the best, I guess, hobby job anyone can have that's a football fan. And like I said, we've done it all together. You know, we've got something that we're extremely proud of. And, you know, things that, you know, be able to do things and see things and, you know, and be in places where I never dreamed of. So I think you know, you yourself, James, should be very proud of what you've achieved with this over the last 8 years. And like you said, it's not the end. It's just a change. And you'll sort of step behind the scenes, you know, more of now of founder emeritus. And yeah, it, like I said, it's been an absolute pleasure. I know we all joke and look, it is about friendship. And like I said, you've been there outside of just football, just everything. And yeah, like I said, and I know that there is our fan base that, you know, that has appreciated. I'm sure over time we'll sort of, you know, show their appreciation as well.
Yeah, for sure. And I suppose above all else, like, we've done a lot of really cool things. I remember doing that live show at the Pig and Whistle for the 2018 World Cup, getting to go to the NPL Grand Finals. They were, like, they've all been great. I've just got a few, like, random memories popping up now as well. Like, that NPL National Finals game at Lions, where they were playing Heidelberg, and there was just the back and forth, not just between the people up there from Lions and the Heidelberg bench, but the Heidelberg bench in and amongst themselves. That is just one of the most random moments I can think of in terms of highlights. But I will say as well, like, we've got a lot to be proud of as well. Like, for me, I think the fact that we've stuck with it through what has been, like, a pretty up and down period for the Roar as well over the last 8 years, it would have been pretty easy to just say, stuff it, can't be bothered anymore, this is all hopeless. But the thing that I'm most proud of is the fact that we haven't done this to try and make money. We've never said, oh, let's go sell ads on the show, let's go pimp out this, let's try and sell people all sorts of Brisbane Football Review merchandise. We've just done it because we enjoyed it. And I think that's probably what I'm most proud of as well, is the fact that we've gone out and churned out, I don't want to say high quality podcasting for the last 8 years, but we've churned out something for the last 8 years. And we've had the spin-offs of the post-game shows, NPL Sunday. It has been a real joy, and I think, you know, I'll just leave off by saying thank you, everyone, for letting us keep you company over the last few years. Scott and Adam aren't going anywhere. I will still be around, but yeah, that's going to be it. So, for the final time, thank you, Adam.
Yes, thank you, James, and good afternoon.
Thank you, Scott.
Pleasure, James. Thank you to the audience as well. We'll be back next season.
Yes, and I will just say thank you, everyone, for listening. Make sure you're getting out to your local NPL grounds over the off-season because there is a lot of good football coming up. And thank you, everyone, for listening, and goodbye.